Call the Senate Committee on Health Policy and Public Affairs to order. Welcome, everybody, and I do have an announcement. We were going to have our meeting at 7:15 on Wednesday, but we didn't post it until this morning at 8:05, so we cannot start before 8:05 on Wednesday. So we will not be starting early, but I do plan to go late today since we don't have floor session until 11 if we can't get through all of our bills today. So, if we aren't done by 10 o'clock. So that's number one. And the others is we have to reconsider the bills that we already passed out of committee, three of them, because, again, we passed them out illegally. They weren't posted with the correct amount of time. And so that's why we're doing that. So,
are you ready, Madam Chair?
I'm ready.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 135.
Senator Gorley moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 135. Is there any objection? The clerk will call the roll since we need four people. But that's all right. You can answer from there.
Senator Carter?
Aye.
Senator Courtney?
Excuse.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Gorley?
Aye.
Chair Monis Anderson?
Aye. Motion passes.
Madam Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 135 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 135 as amended was sent to the floor. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. And do you want to explain what happened with the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 135 requires occupational therapists and occupational therapist assistants comply with continuing education requirements, revises certain provisions related to scope of practice for occupational therapy. There is a dash one amendment which removes the American Occupational Therapy Association proposed definition for measure in order to keep current definition of occupational therapy.
Thank you. I'm opening a work session on Senate Bill 135.
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 135.
Senator Gordley moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 135. Any discussion? Any oppositions? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move that Senate Bill 135, as amended, be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves Senate Bill 135 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And I do not remember who was carrying that bill. Senator Gordley was. Okay. All right, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 135. And let's move to Senate Bill 24.
Is it SJR 24?
SJR 20.
Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on SJR 24.
Senator Gordley moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on SJR 24. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which SJR 24 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves we reconsider the vote by which SJR 24 was sent to the floor. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. And briefly, this was concerning, just what was it concerning?
The importance of healthcare workforce in Oregon.
Okay. I'm opening a work session on SJR 24.
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendment to SJR 24.
The dash one amendment, Senator Gordley moves them. Any discussion? Oh, no, there's no dash ones. It's just an SJR.
Okay, I move the... So I'm moving SJR 24.
Okay. Senator Gordley moves SJR 24 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. I will close the work session on SJR 24. And now I'm going to open a work session on SB 604. Shannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 604 appropriates money from the general fund to the Department of Human Services for psychiatric day treatment for Eastern Oregon children. Declares emergency, takes effect July 1st, 2007. There is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
And we didn't do this one before.
No.
Okay. All right. Bob Nichols.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Nichols, Assistant Director for the Department of Human Services, and I'm responsible for the Addictions and Mental Health Division. I apologize. I thought I had written testimony on Senate Bill 604. I'll find it and get it to you. But I basically wanted to just say that the division takes reluctantly an opposed position on this bill, primarily for two reasons. One is this is not in the governor's recommended budget. And secondly, this bill, although it would go to support a very good program, there are many other good programs as well that are just as deserving as with additional state general fund support. And so our concern is simply that this doesn't seem like the way to equitably distribute resources around the state. We already have those issues in most areas of mental health and addictions in the state general fund area. So I reluctantly have to testify in opposition, but certainly feel that the program that you have before you is a deserving program. There are many other such deserving programs. I'd be
Thank
happy
you.
To answer any questions. Oh, if I could, please, Madam Chair. Senator Carter asked to get a breakdown on the funding for children's mental health, and I have provided that under a separate cover. I'm not sure if it's arrived yet, but I wanted to respond to the question that Senator Carter raised about the overall funding for children's mental health. The large bulk of it is in the Oregon Health Plan Medicaid Managed Care area.
Colleagues, thank you. You remember that we discussed this bill and we had it, and I know that Senator Nelson would be here. He strongly advocates for this bill, as well as Representative Jensen. And I would like to know the wishes of the committee, but is there any discussion at this point in time?
I think it should be, Madam Chair, in the sense that the co-chairs have zeroed out an equitable plan that gives monies to counties right now, and it's really creating a problem in terms of how we distribute dollars to mental health. And, and I don't know how we get around this. And even though I recognize this program, think it's a good program, as does Mr. Nichol. But I think we have to resolve that as a body. We have to resolve the issue of equity to different counties along this line. And right now I don't have any idea, members, how we do that. And so with us not trying to deal with that issue in budget right now, I don't know how else we do that. In terms of continuing to give monies along those lines for treatment program.
I know that if you recall the testimony that we had, managed care is not working, from what I hear, as well in Eastern Oregon as it does other places. And so it's getting back to Senator Carter's equity issue. And I would be most comfortable in putting this in the Ways and Means Committee to deal with the monies and the equity everywhere. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm wondering what part of the state the mental health system's working well in, because certainly not in mine. And, right. And a lot of it's structural, a lot of it's funding, clearly. I'm one of the sponsors of this bill because I think it's a valuable program, and it's a vital program. Mm-hmm. But there are day treatment, as Bob said, day treatment programs all over the state that I think also need to be considered. Madam Chair, I guess from my perspective, I have no problem sending this bill to Ways and Means to be considered, but as we look at the entire scope of the mental health need, I would prefer that we send it without recommendation, just so it's a piece of the puzzle
right.
that the Ways and Means Committee will deal with.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Several thoughts about this, the measure, which I do support. One of the things that we heard in our last hearing, Madam Chair, was that in 2003, there was a total of 7 slots for day treatment for children with mental health disorders in the 12 easternmost counties in Oregon. So clearly, there is a need and there is a gap in available services. I would support sending this measure to Ways and Means with the understanding that the proposal will be looked at against the community, not against, but together with the Community Services Work Group report. Am I referencing that report correctly?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, the Community Services Work Group report only looked at adult services because it was related to the state hospital. Since we no longer serve children in the state hospital, it did not focus on the needs of children.
Okay. That linkage won't work. But with that said, to send it to Ways and Means with the idea that this will be looked at, considering that there are needs all around the state, and with an understanding that we need to look at where does this piece fit. Also understanding that the co-chair's budget leaves us far short of where we need to be in investing in the children's mental health system as
right.
well as the adult mental health system.
All right. Well, I think I hear the sense. I'm going to close the public hearing on, or no, we're in a work session, right?
Yes.
Yeah, we're in work session.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 604 to the full Ways and Means Committee.
Senator Gordley moves Senate Bill 604 to the full Ways and Means Committee. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 604, and I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 791. And Bob Nickel and Jim Davis.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Jim Davis, today representing United Seniors, Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens, the Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disabilities, Save Oregon Seniors, and the Gray Panthers. We are part of the Coalition for Responsible Treatment, which is a coalition of around 25 groups that our sole purpose is serving the mental health and addiction needs of the underserved, which is seniors, people with disabilities, and ethnic minorities. And so that is our purpose, and this is a bill that we would like, that this is our second session with this bill, and we're strongly supporting Senate Bill 791 because it would develop a task force on mental health and addiction services for the underserved population. and would finally allow the players to come to the table and begin to take a look at mental health and addiction problems of these populations, and particularly lack of access to needed services. It's the culmination, this has been the culmination of a number of years of forums that we've been holding in the community and attracting hundreds of providers and advocates and consumers. Our last forum for the underserved in mental health was last November. We attracted 110 participants, and so came out with a lot of great recommendations, and actually I was thinking I should forward those to you because I think you would find those interesting. So the one thing that we do want to mention, the last session we came in with this bill, and then DHS came in and said and attached a $160,000 price tag to this effort, which was ludicrous, and we thought was only a way to kill this piece of legislation. We actually would see this as more of a community grassroots effort from within the consumer and advocate communities and within the mental health community, and we really just want to get people around a table in a task force that will be respected, and it's not going to cost that much money, and very little money actually, and we would ask that this not be referred to Ways and Means, and that it just go to the floor of the Senate. So that's just a request that we make, and I don't know how much opportunity there will be for that to happen. But if I might, I wanted to just discuss very briefly our frustration with the lack of response to these underserved populations. The senior and disability populations have the highest rates of mental health and addiction problems in our society, yet they are completely alienated from our mental health and addiction systems. This is something I teach at a university level all the time, and seniors are at risk of more life transitions and more life adjustments than any other population, and because of that have the highest risk of depression, anxiety, sleep disturbances, things such as that. People with disabilities have just as many life transitions, if not more, also dealing with their physical conditions and things such as that, and yet you can't even really find anything about the mental health and addiction needs of people with disabilities. I mean, it's a very hidden problem, but we know in our communities what our people with disabilities are going through. National figures are showing 15 to 25% of the senior population have depression problems that would require intervention, 10 to 15% addiction problems. It's hard to figure those type of things out because there's not much outreach into that community, but one area where you can really see it is when you look at the suicide statistics, and I know that some legislators were pretty shocked to see some of those statistics in the last few years, but I wrote my dissertation on community mental health needs of the elderly, and those statistics haven't changed much in the last 30 years. The seniors had the highest suicide rate, the highest rate of success in suicide, and I believe one of the principal reasons that is the case is because we aren't reaching out to their mental health and addiction needs. And it's just, and I think that's a very sad solution to that problem. And then we began to look at partners, and we thought the most logical partner, and it turned out to be such, was the ethnic minority community. And that's when we formed our coalition together, because they were being, ethnic minorities are being ignored in the system the same way our seniors and people with disabilities are. So it just makes sense for us to join together in coalition and try to figure out a way that these underserved populations can better access these services. If you look at the ethnic minority statistics, the Surgeon General's report found that 21% of all Americans suffer from mental illness. But then when you start looking at African Americans, Hispanics, Native Americans, Asian Americans, those statistics start to shoot up. And addiction statistics start to shoot up. And you begin to wonder why this is. And a lot of those are the severe roadblocks within the system, and severe roadblocks for all these populations in being able to reach out to them. But certainly there are severe roadblocks around cultural diversity and difficulties within the system to be able to communicate with those populations and to reach out to them adequately. But it really is true across the board. There are communication problems on every level. When I wrote my dissertation 26 years ago, what we found was that the community mental health population was really geared to a younger or middle-aged population, and that the staffs really weren't even geared to dealing with the senior population. And I just think there needs to be a real shift in how mental health and addiction services looks at how they're going to reach out to these underserved populations. And this task force would provide the means to do that. And so we strongly urge your support of Senate Bill 791.
Other questions?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Some suggestions. I support the intent of the measure. I think there needs to be some consistency in language in the bill. The references to ethnic minorities, I would urge us to change that reference to racial and ethnic populations.
Sure.
So that we are consistent with the Oregon Progress Board and the way in which they collect data and report on the progress of Oregon's racial and ethnic populations in a number of benchmark categories, including health. So just we need some consistency in language.
That's an excellent idea. Mm-hmm.
The other recommendation is that where on line 22 we say we would want two persons experienced with programs related to multicultural health, may I suggest that we have an Office of Multicultural Health in the Department of Human Services, and the inclusion of that office in the lineup of folks who would serve on the task force should be included.
Okay.
Explicitly.
Okay.
And then the other thing, and this is just an FYI, I don't see Senator Winter's name as one of the sponsors, or Senator Carter, and or myself. And most certainly, I know that we would want to be, if I may speak for the three of us who've been working on these issues since we landed in the building, most certainly would want to be involved in any efforts to move these issues forward.
If I might, Michelle, Madam Chair, and Senator Gordley, the names you just mentioned are our champions. You are our champions. And, you know, unfortunately with these processes, oftentimes we're given hours, sometimes days to get these bills, put in. But, yes, we'd love to have your names at the head of the list.
The other thing I would point out to you and to all of us, I think we have an opportunity here to revisit the work of Governor Kitzhaber's Racial and Ethnic Health Task Force and look at where there is alignment in the work of that task force and its findings and recommendations with the future work of a task force as that work is described and defined here in Senate Bill 791.
We would have no problem with any of the amendments that you mentioned, and if we can just talk about some process to get that done if this is going to move.
And then lastly, I just sincerely appreciate your leadership, Mr. Davis, in continuing to bring these issues forward and always including these issues in your conversations about health and mental health. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
This is an idea, and I think that definitely the committee supports what the intent of this bill. We have the Governor's Task Force on Drug Prevention. I forget the whole name of it. Anyway, Drug and Alcohol Prevention. We have that. Mm-hmm. We have the Governor's Racial and Ethnic Task Force. They're already in existence. What if we...
The Governor's Racial and Ethnic Health Task Force no longer...
Oh, it no exists. Longer exists.
It was brought into being in the Kitzhaber administration and did present a report and findings and recommendations, and those recommendations, some of them, some of them, very few of them, are being implemented.
And I read those.
There's much work to do.
Yeah. Well, what I was thinking, trying to take an existing task force, and the one that came to my mind was the Governor's Task Force on Drug and Alcohol Prevention, and mandating a subgroup from that to work this so that, and I don't know who would testify for the Governor, Ann Uller probably. I know Sharon Kelly's on that.
I would object to that approach, Madam Chair. One of the problems we've had all along is that these issues have either been not addressed or they've been an add-on, addendum, afterthought. And these are issues that are deserving of full attention. These are national issues. There's a national movement looking at racial and ethnic health disparities, physical health and mental health. And Oregon at one time, you know, we were a part of that leadership wave looking at these issues. We lost that leadership role when Governor Kitzhaber stepped off the scene, frankly. And this bill would give us an opportunity to reclaim that ground and start to focus on these issues in a laser-like way. Again, not as a subcommittee or as a subgroup or as a add-on, but with a the full attention of a group looking at the health and well-being of Oregon's underserved populations.
Mm-hmm. And the only reason I mention that is that it has gone to Ways and Means and it has died. And that's what I want to avoid. I agree totally with you that the attention has to be, we need to get our focus back on our underserved populations. And I don't want it to die in Ways and Means, so I'm trying to be a little creative in how this can be mandated to maybe an existing one. But again, I don't know how the main committees work, and I'm not on the Ways and Means.
I think in the past, if I may, if we can continue our conversation here, Madam Chair, yes, in the past, attempts to focus on this public policy area have failed, as we've tried to get Ways and Means to address the issues. But that's the past. We have new leadership. We have House and Senate. We have a newly constituted Ways and Means Committee. I would like to think that we also have a new way or new ways of looking at these issues and how we're going to bring all of our Oregon communities along. So I would like to think that we will not have another missed opportunity here to address communities and concerns that are all of Oregon's concerns. And I think that's the message that I would want to see us send down to Ways and Means. This is work that we must do. And that's the message that needs to go along with the bill.
Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, if I might, the one caveat to what you're saying is that you'd have to divide up addictions and mental health. And I think in any kind of task force, those issues should stay together. And I think with this one, I agree with Senator Gordley that we have a chance to really have a concentrated effort, not an ongoing effort, but just a concentrated effort to make some recommendations to the legislature about how we should deal with this problem. And just to get all the players together at one time to do this, I think would be an effective way to do it.
Question? Yes.
How much will this task force cost?
Well, you know, I was just thinking about that the past few days, and I just can't imagine it costing even more than the level that would be needed for it to be sent to Ways and Means. Because we're not looking for any kind of fancy staffing. We're not looking for anything. We're looking for just the basic task force to get the players together and get the job done. $160,000, I kind of laughed last year, or 2 years ago, because we could organize a whole statewide campaign and have forums everywhere and do all kinds of wonderful things for $160,000. This thing shouldn't cost that much money at all. We just need to get people together to talk.
Question to Mr. Nichol.
Yes.
Mr. Nichol, how much do you think a task force...
20 members. 20 members.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, again, my name is Bob Nickel, Assistant Director of DHS and in charge of mental health and, or addictions and mental health division. Our fiscal analysis on this really is based on lines on the second page of the bill. You'll look at starting with line 25, section 11, the Department of Human Services shall provide staff support to the task force. We estimate that we would need 0.15 FTE to do this according to how the bill is written.
0.15,
and that comes to a little under $7,000, $6,984 at the staff level that was assumed here. The real cost here is not $160,000 this time, but we put a total cost of $96,000. Just a little under $90,000 is there because, again, the bill reads, following down there on lines 26 through 31, that's section 12, members of the task force who are not members of the Legislative Assembly are not entitled to compensation, but may be reimbursed for actual and necessary travel. Goes on to say claims for expenses incurred in performing functions of the task force shall be paid out of funds appropriated to the Department of Human Services. So the bill's language is really what leads to the fiscal impact here. And we're totally supportive of the concept, but we're remaining neutral just because we've had enough experience trying to do task forces that have important jobs to do and try to do them on zero or so minimal leads to a poor quality product. So, I mean, we're perfectly happy to sit down and talk further with the sponsors of the bill about how to do this and do a quality job. This is a huge set of issues, and I think for us to put no fiscal impact wouldn't be consistent with the bill or with the intent, frankly. So that's the position that we're taking.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Carter.
Dr. Davis, do you see what that last line could be explicated, and that would take that impact away? And I would personally volunteer to help raise some money for maybe $7,000 for DHS staff for us to give money to them for the other piece.
Senator Carter, Madam Chair. Oh, absolutely. You know, we kind of developed this language. It was kind of your typical task force kind of language, mm-hmm. but we definitely are willing to take that kind of stuff out because we know that this is going to be mainly a volunteer effort of people that are really concerned about this. And, you know, some staff time is fine, but people like myself who've been doing this stuff for 30-plus years, you know, I'll be willing to just give my time to this effort. And I know others that will, too. And so, and I know the Governor's Commission on Senior Services.
I want to be
crazy
official
about
though.
It. So, mm-hmm. so I think we could do this easily for way under 50.
I think if we take this last piece off, and we'll just try to raise some money so that we can have official information to go in and with the DHS person from Mr. Nichols' office. I don't want to embarrass him today by calling him Dr. Nickel, even though he deserves it. So that I think will that do the job, Ms. Nichol?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, that would help a lot. I mean, truly, this is an area that we're concerned about. We're working on already, and if it was just a matter of the staff time, I would find a way to absorb that.
I mean,
the fiscal impact people look at these things; they take seriously what's in the language of the bill.
And we should.
So that's the reason for us. Providing the information that we have on this. But I certainly would be willing to work with this.
Madam Chair, are we in work session?
No. I have some other comments. If we had, and this is going to financing, because I know that there are some people that would love to serve on this, but would need mileage and would need to have, if they come from Eastern Oregon, a way to stay overnight if it's a one day. And I wanted to ask Senator Courtney if there's an interim task force. This is just ideas. Does that travel come out of DHS, or would that come out of the President's Office's budget?
DHS
still would.
Yeah.
What
do you mean, legislators or other people?
Yeah, if you were to appoint a task force, sir.
If you were to appoint a task force on this, would all of the expenses come out of DHS, or would they come out of your budget?
I don't know that answer.
It would come out of his office.
I need to.
Well, it depends on how it's written.
Yeah, that's it. I'm not prepared to say right now until I know better. I don't want to give misleading information.
No, Senator Gordon.
Just another thought to consider. How was the governor's mental health task force staffed, Governor Kulongoski's task force?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I believe it was staffed primarily with Aaron Kelly Seal in the governor's office. I don't recall now whether there was mileage reimbursement. I don't believe our office was responsible for that. I would have to go back and double check.
And what I would add to that, the previous, the other racial and ethnic health task force was staffed through the governor's office, Governor Kitzhaber's office. All the staff support came through his office. The mental health alignment work group task force also was staffed by Governor Kitzhaber's office. I'm just suggesting that there's another model for staffing and funding that we may not want to rule out as we're looking at how to get this done and how to get it done well and effectively, and also, frankly, elevate the issues to the level of importance that they deserve.
I feel this session finally. Mental health and drug and alcohol addiction is coming to the forefront. And I feel very strongly that I don't want things fragmented and having a task force here and a task force there. It really needs, and that has to come under the DHS purview, but we need to know what the various task forces are saying so that, because there's only a finite amount of money. So I with that in mind, I don't have a problem. Is there any other testimony or questions at this point in time?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Obviously, this bill is going to be coming back with amendments.
Yes.
And I would request, Madam Chair, that we also at that point in time get back the number of task force on mental health that have been convened over the last 20 years and an executive summary, because Senator Gordy and I served on Governor Kitzhaber's mental health task force. It was an exhausting body of work that is still just languishing somewhere out in Never Never Land.
That's what I want to avoid.
And so I guess I kind of agree that we need to see a nexus and see the pieces that are already in place, see where the gaps are. And I know we continue to study things. And it's almost like studying things is easier than solving problems. But and that's not saying that this isn't important work and it doesn't need to be done, but it'd be nice to see where this fits in with the construct of what we already have as far as recommendations that have been made by groups similar to this, and to kind of get a sense of why we haven't moved on those recommendations as well.
Andrea Carter.
Yes. Madam Chair.
She has to leave, and then...
Would you forgive me, because many times I don't mean to sound caustic and people think I do, but what I'm about to say is going to sound that way. I've been here for 22 years. Been working on mental health for 22 years. This is the first time we've had something of this nature to come up. No other group has studied the issue. No other group has brought its attention. I think that this is a standalone issue at this point. If we don't take this opportunity now, it might not come our way again. What I would like, Dr. Davis, to happen is for you to give me a little time. And we will have this.
Okay, cool.
All right, give me a little time, and we will have this. And I don't want to connect it to anything else. It's my preference, Madam Chair. It's your decision, so I want to respect that. But I think it deserves its own body of data. And then, you are so right. How do we nexus that data with the ongoing data is important. But I think in the researching of it so that you can have informed information about what is out there and why it's not working is deserving of the kind of data gathering that they're talking about doing here, if you don't mind.
How much time would it be for you to get to us what this task force that are in existence now regarding mental health and drug addiction and racial and minority disparities, so that we could have that? Is it possible to have that information by Wednesday? Because I want to move this bill. I was hoping to move it today, but I'd like to move. But I think we need more information at this point.
Madam Chair, we should be able to have it by Wednesday, particularly if we go to, at least to the executive summary and the recommendations. Those are pretty available.
All right.
And I will make every effort to get it by Wednesday morning.
Okay.
My staff is probably cringing back at the office, but we'll
I'm sure they are. Yeah. Yes.
If I might interject, Senator Carter actually was correct in that we have been crying at all these, trying to scream out our message at all these type of processes, and we have found that very few have dealt with the problems of the underserved. Sometimes there's virtually nothing, so I don't think it's going to be terribly hard to find. We certainly can provide you. I've written a couple of state plans around some of these issues. I've done other things like that. We can provide you with that information. But unfortunately, that's why we're pushing this forward as we are, is because unfortunately there hasn't been an emphasis placed on the underserved in some of these task forces that should have been. But we should gather all the data. I totally agree. We should gather everything that's out there, because a lot of the approaches that are working for these other populations would work for us as well.
But I do think that we need to know that our mental health and our drug addiction and alcohol prevention is not up to par in this state.
No, it's
and
not.
So it's yes, the underserved populations, but we have the whole population. I mean, and so that's why I get a little nervous about just taking out a little segment, putting a lot of money into that, when we have the whole population that is not receiving the needs regarding mental health and drug addiction prevention. So that's why I really feel there needs to be I see the need to have that, but I see a need to a comprehensive approach, which we have to have, and I'm not sure if we have a bill for that yet. Yes.
One of the things that's missing in our conversation, missing for me, and I think missing for all of us, if I may say it in that way, is context. What needs to be included in this conversation about this bill, in the place of this bill in the scheme of things, is a conversation led by the Office of Multicultural Health that can help us understand where we are and where we are not, and what the and clearly understand what the opportunity is. And Madam Chair, you'll recall that some weeks ago I suggested that we invite the Office of Multicultural Health in to do an informational session with us to paint that picture for us, and I'm going to make that request again. I know that, you know, we're up against deadlines and 200 bills in committee and all the rest of that, but if we want to make good public policy here that is in service to all of Oregon and that is in service to those populations that have historically lagged behind, and that's a part of what this is about, populations that have lagged behind because we have failed to implement policies that would address the populations. We have failed to invest dollars, resources in populations. Until and unless we have that comprehensive kind of conversation, we won't fully understand the place of a Senate Bill 791. That's what's missing for me in this conversation this morning. And the last thing I wanted to say is that I think it's unfair to say that the Kitzhaber Mental Health Alignment Work Group report is on a shelf languishing, and it's unfair to say that the Kulongoski report is somewhere on a shelf languishing. No, we are drawing on those findings and recommendations from both of those reports. And that work is finding its way into the conversation we're having today, and it's finding its way into other public policy discussions that are happening inside this building and in other places. So I think sometimes our rhetoric does disservice to work that is going forward, and we just need to be mindful. We need to be mindful of that.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, if we will need some amendments, and hopefully if you'll work with Alana and Shannon, I'm not sure when she'll be back, get those submitted today or tomorrow so that we can have them for Wednesday.
Sure.
But then working with Bob Nicol, and if we don't have it for Wednesday, we don't have it for Wednesday. We are going to move this bill, and so do you have any comments?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we will have them by Wednesday.
Okay, great. All right,
thank you so much.
I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 791. I'll open public hearing on Senate Bill 519. Shan, or Elena.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 519 requires health insurers and Department of Human Services through state medical assistance programs to cover services performed using telemedicine. Requires the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services and the Director of Human Services to adopt rules.
Okay, Cedric, Hayden, and I'm sorry that the sponsor of the bill, Norwood Knight Richardson, is not here. He's the one that submitted this. Is there anyone else you would like to be up here with you? Okay.
No, thank you, Madam Chair and Senators and Madam Administrator. Yes, I think all the people that wish to testify left a space there for the primary sponsor to sign their name. As you will see, we left several blank spaces, so we're sorry that they are not here because we would have liked to hear their presentation. and I might present a slightly different application than they might, so I was anxious to hear from them. For the record, my name is Cedric Hayden. I'm from Falls Creek in Adams County.
Just one moment. Did I have you describe the bill? Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay.
For the record, my name is Cedric Hayden from Lane County. I'm dental director for Hayden Family Dentistry Group, and I'm pleased to testify today in support of Senate Bill 519, which, among other things, provides for the reimbursement of telemedicine. Particularly, the bill mentions medically underserved areas and improving patient access in geographic areas where there's a shortage. There are a number of, for purposes of this discussion, may I please use the term teledentistry, which is found in a number of texts, including this text that I will cite. Teledentistry is useful in correctional settings because diagnosis can be made on camera with an aide holding the camera, talking to the patient, the inmate, and the dentist at a remote location quizzing the patient. The diagnosis and suggested treatment can be done in institutional settings. Now, not every institution has a resident dental staff. Some prisons and most jails have no resident dentist. So teledentistry would minimize the cost of transporting inmates to a specialist because it could save several trips. So that's a useful thing. And that is discussed in this text, which I cite in my written text. Another thing that is not in my text is that, it was precipitated by an editorial in the Register Guard this morning, is that these vehicles that I will describe are capable of satellite transmission from remote locations, and if there is a disruption of the communication service by natural disaster or terrorist activity, they remain functional. They would be very hard to take out because the ones I'm describing are mobile. And they will be in rural locations. And it's something that it might be considered to incorporate into the incident command structure, that the county sheriffs would utilize the services of these mobile units for command and control. They are self-contained. They have generators. They have batteries on board. And as long as they have fuel, they can function. Now, in to get a little closer to my particular subject, which is dentistry for low-income people, the 2005 Legislative Assembly in House Bill 5023, Budget Note 4, instructed DMAP and DHS to pursue strategies to increase the care delivered to fully capitated health plans and dental care organization auto-enrollment that would increase the percentage of people covered by our managed care OHP. I think that the medical component has reached in excess of 75%. Probably 75% of the people in Oregon on the OHP plan have a medical home. Happily, over 90% have a dental home. However, this still leaves an uncertain number, at least 8,000, maybe 30,000 people who have no dental home. They are underserved or not served at all. And a program like this with telemedicine, with mobile vehicles, would increase access to these people in the rural hinterlands of Oregon. DHS last week testified before the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services, and they assured the committee, in response to a direct question from some of the committee members, that they were in fact seeking to increase access for dental care for these people. And this is one way to improve access. The group I represent, Hayden Family Dentistry Group, has been a dental contractor for, in one capacity or another, since the inception of the Oregon Health Plan in 1994. We currently serve about 31,000 members. We have, for the last 6 years, been providing a demonstration project with mobile vehicles to rural Oregon, and telemedicine, teledentistry would be one way that we could increase and expand our service to these people. In fact, it would certainly be possible at some not too far distant future to include a medical and nursing component on these vans. So in conclusion, we urge a do-pass recommendation for Senate Bill 519. We do not believe there will be any significant fiscal impact. We would ask that it not be referred to Ways and Means, in that the fee-for-service patients are in budget. The managed care patients, the standard population, are off budget. There is no general fund involved in their care. They are funded by provider taxes, which the dental care organizations pay, melded with federal funds. And, of course, the health insurance, the private health insurers, are off budget also. We would also ask that it be legislative intent that mobile dental and medical service utilizing teledentistry and telemedicine be recognized as meeting the protocols required in Section 3. There's a typo here. In Section 3, Sub 2, Sub A of this bill. And recent studies done by staff of OMAP have indicated that mobile service is equal in quality and quantity to the physical brick-and-mortar clinics. I have attached several types of pictures of several types of vehicles. The one on the top is the one that we sponsor, one of several that we're planning. And if this bill were to pass, we would equip these with satellite coverage. Currently, we use satellite phones and cell phones, but with satellite coverage, discs and so on, satellite discs, we could transmit digital x-rays, we could do real-time video conferencing with the patient and serve this community better. The pictures at the bottom are from my alma mater, where I took my public health training, this is a very high-tech vehicle that is an off-road vehicle, and you might be at some time late night when you have nothing to do, be interested in watching the 6-minute video on how telemedicine works. And it would be, we don't have one in Oregon, so this is just for your entertainment, but they would be particularly applicable to the exigencies referred to in Section 3BE of the bill, where they're disasters declared by the governor. So I thank you for your time and ask if there are any questions.
Okay. Thank you. It's nice to see you again, and nice that you're working for the dental care population. I need you to answer some questions regarding utilization, because whenever we start going into telemedicine, I keep thinking, how is this really going to affect utilization? And so I would like you to describe what actually, when I went to my dentist in December, they had these video things. So he was able to look in my mouth, and I had something wrong. I forget what it was. And I saw it on screen. I thought, great, this would be so useful if you had someone who knew how to manipulate the equipment. But then I want to know, is that equipment going to be charged, and is your mobile unit going to be charged, covered, or what service would be covered under telemedicine? That's what I want to know.
I think the essence of this bill is that in a prison situation where a prison staff member would transmit information to a dentist in a remote location, that the dentist in the remote location, who is an independent contractor, would be paid. Apparently, and I don't know the answer to this, but apparently there's some question as to whether DHS and DMAP would pay for consultations that are not face-to-face. So I think this is to make teleconferencing, which is perfectly practical, the equivalent of a face-to-face. So everything that you saw in the office, rather than using that internally, if we had this mobile vehicle in Crane, it could transmit those images to a specialist in Portland and say, what do you think? Is this a carcinoma? Is this a temporomandibular joint problem? Should we bring them to Portland, or will you see them on your next visit to Crane?
Well, what I'm asking is, so it's the consult that's going to be paid for, because we still, if there was actually something that needed to be done, that patient would still have to be then transported somewhere where there was a medical professional that would have to do the whatever.
What we envision is that the diagnosis, the treatment, diagnosis and treatment planning would be done by video conferencing, which would save a trip for the dentist or the patient one way or the other. And we're talking hundreds of miles of transportation from Eastern Oregon here, so it's a real factor. And then at selected intervals, the dentist would visit that community in this unit. This unit is equipped with two dental chairs. It travels with a dentist, a dental hygienist, sometimes a registered nurse, a dental assistant, and a driver technician.
Thank you.
Madam
yes.
Chair, I'm concerned that the requester of the bill is not present, and I know how important the bill this bill is to Dr. Norwood Knight Richardson. Did we attempt to get him by phone, or what happened?
Yeah, Shannon is not here. So what I would like, to actually carry this bill over to Wednesday to see if we can get a hold of him so we can have further. Thank you, Dr. Hayden. So if we could do that, because he will be vital to the testimony.
And Senator Atkinson as well. They've talked a great deal about
I don't know why Senator Atkinson isn't here.
Okay.
All right. Chris Schultz, Peace Health. Did those amendments ever get done?
Not that I know.
Okay.
Good morning, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. I'm Chris Schultz representing Peace Health. Peace Health has hospitals in Eugene, Florence, in Cottage Grove, and soon to be in Springfield. We support the concept of Senate Bill 519 and have consulted with Senator Atkinson and with Dr. Norwood Knight Richardson about a couple of proposed amendments. Senator Mona Sanderson was nice enough to allow us those to get drafted, but I don't think they've showed up yet. I actually spoke with Dr. Knight Richardson this morning. He has some concerns about the amendments, which is why they're not in front of you today for any action about whether federal law would permit the amendments that we had proposed. And I think because the bill was scheduled relatively quickly, and I think folks haven't had a chance to check it out with all the lawyers yet, I think we do need a little bit of time on that, if you don't mind. But I'd like to briefly describe to you our concerns. Telemedicine has several benefits. I think one thing to keep in mind is the scheduling problems. If you go to see your primary care physician and you need a consult by a specialist, scheduling that appointment 2 weeks later at a separate location, there's a lot of complexity involved in that. Telemedicine can be used to get that consult at the time you're already in the office. For Peace Health, with a network of four hospitals, reducing vehicle trips, either physicians or patients, between the set of four hospitals is a big consideration in an area that's increasingly urbanizing and traffic's becoming a problem. And it's better when patients can receive treatment in their own communities at small hospitals instead of being transferred to the larger hospital where there are more resources available. We have three concerns about the bill. I'll just cover them really briefly. One is that the goal should be expanded beyond serving underserved communities. I understand that Senator Atkinson's concern. The bill says specifically that the goal of this bill is to increase healthcare access to people who are in underserved communities or where there aren't enough specialists. We think the goal should be broader. Second thing is the bill says that you can't use fax or telephone when video conference is otherwise available. We've all sat through a million committee hearings where somebody took 15 minutes to set up a PowerPoint presentation when they could have covered their points in 30 seconds. We're not sure that the legislation should say that. The bill would require DHS and then DCBS to establish rules, and if we want to talk about that in the rulemaking process, we think that might be appropriate. But to say in legislation that video conference is always better than fax or telephone, we think might not be right. The third thing and the most problematic thing is the bill would require face-to-face visits if the patient is within a reasonable distance. In the case of Peace Health, we have hospitals, Cottage Grove, Florence, Eugene, that really aren't that far apart. The question is, what is a reasonable distance? If the bill says that we have a preference for putting people in their cars and making them drive between hospitals over telemedicine, we think that might not be the right approach. And would, again, because the bill would require DHS and DCBS to adopt rules, that instead be removed from the bill and that be dealt with in the rulemaking process. Again, apologize for not having actual amendments in front of you, but wanted to explain this to you and would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Well, the intent I know from Dr. Richardson, I always forget his total name, Knight Richardson, wanted to really focus on the rural area, and Eugene isn't really the rural area, and so that was his point, but I'd rather hear it from him.
Madam Chair, and appreciating that point, the way the bill is structured is it would require DHS and then DCBS to set telemedicine rules for the entire state, and I think our concern is if the rules were to go into effect and we were to say that telemedicine is only appropriate for rural or underserved populations, I'm not sure it's a policy call. That's the call the legislature would want to make, and we wanted to bring to your attention that certainly there is a problem in rural and underserved communities, but whether the bill that you adopt should prohibit the use of telemedicine in more urbanized areas is something we wanted to bring to your attention and have a conversation about.
Definitely, yes. All right, thank you very much. Any questions? John Powell.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Madam Chair and members, this Senate Bill 519 does two basic things. It creates a new mandate for commercial health insurers, and secondly, it specifies procedures applicable to Oregon Medical Assistance Program. Our comments are obviously directed at the commercial insurance side of the equation. We have two medical doctors who have reviewed this, Dr. Stephen Goldberg and Dr. Terry Olson, who are Regents medical directors, and they have clarified for us that Regents has adopted the CMS guidelines for telemedicine, and we do pay in our commercial products according to the federal guidelines, and we believe changes in telemedicine should use the federal guidelines as a basis for moving forward. To create a dual-track system will be administratively burdensome, particularly for third-party payers. Some of the problems that we have with the current wording in the bill deal with the definition of health professional and of telemedicine. The definition of health professional references ORS 676.162. This is much broader than the CMS language. For example, under CSM requirements, coverage and reimbursement is due to physicians, nurse practitioners, clinical nurse specialists, physician assistants, nurse midwives, clinical psychologists, clinical social workers, registered dietitians, and nutritionists. under the reference to Senate Bill or to RS 676162, it would include emergency medical technicians, radiological technologists, pharmacists, optometrists, naturopaths, chiropractors, nursing home administrator, massage therapists, all acting within their scope of practice. And we think that is too broad. Insurers in these sections are mandated to pay the provider types for telemedicine as long as they're operating within their scope of practice. Reimbursement is not tied in this bill to the benefits under the insurance policy, nor is it tied to any kind of a network participation. So closed panels and others would have to pay any provider that's listed in 676162 acting in their scope of practice. Under the definition of telemedicine, we think that is very broad too, although it relies upon rulemaking and includes any form of telecommunication technology.
What is covered now?
Let me see if I can quickly reference.
Are phone consults covered?
They are.
Faxes, are they covered?
Madam Chair, again, I think it would depend. It depends upon what the procedure is. For example, review of an X-ray that's sent telephonically is paid for. Those types of services, consultations. But I'll have to get back to you on all of those specifics.
That's all right.
Again, we're scrambling, I think, as the sponsor of the bill is on the timeline to get ready for this bill. As you know,
this was one we had actually scheduled a week in advance.
We've been preparing for lots of bills.
Yes, I know, yeah.
On both sides. Again, when it comes to the definition section of telemedicine, reimbursement is not tied to covered benefits or medical necessity or evidence-based criteria or any reference to CMS requirements. So with that, Madam Chair and members, I'd be glad to answer questions I can answer, and definitely this area would need more expertise from our company and perhaps from other third-party payers and health systems going forward.
Thank you. I like the idea of telemedicine. I feel it helps provide for a seamless care for patients. But we'll see. One other, thank you,
Madam Chair.
Powell,
that is why Regents has adopted the CMS guidelines and is, in fact, in their commercial policies currently providing for it, because we do see the benefit of telemedicine as well.
It would be nice if you could contact the sponsor of the bill. I'm in staff. When we call him to say we would like him to testify, it can be by phone. If he cannot be here in person, we want to know if sometime between 8 and... at 10, you know, on Wednesday, because I plan to bring this back when we have, and if he's not able to do that, then we'll just have to schedule it on the days that he can. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Atkinson is here, and he is the chief sponsor of the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jason Atkinson, state senator from Southern Oregon. Thank you. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, for hearing the bill. And I know that you had it scheduled earlier, and I think it was your Dayton Burns, I believe.
Okay.
But thank you very much. Let me. There's two reasons why I drafted the bill. Actually, three. And the A number one certainly would be the request of the bill, Dr. Knight Richardson. But the two reasons why I got interested in it was, first of all, I live in an ONC county, a county that last Friday we shut all the doors of the library.
And ONC is?
Oregon, California, Timber Receipt County.
Yes.
So does Senator Cruz. And our, in exchange for not cutting timber, there was a federal settlement for us to receive timber receipts, and from those timber receipts, they've now evaporated. And my local communities passed a bond measure several years ago, passed a huge amount of libraries. We built libraries in every city, and now we can't operate the libraries. Libraries were chained shut on Friday. Mm-hmm. Now, well, how does that lead to telehealth? Well, one of the biggest at-risk populations from ONC funding is how the counties do medical, mental care, mental health services. And it has always been an issue for us that if ONC dried up, the local counties who currently do mental health treatment are going to tell the state, you do it, and you, we all know that the state is going to have a difficult time handling the work and the caseload for mental health services as it relates to our counties. Not only would that be very cumbersome, but as you probably would well imagine, Oregonians would fall through the cracks. This bill, I saw, and the concept actually working with Dr. Knight Richardson all summer on it, and just talking about it, how would this work and have you tested it, and in so doing, would it actually help if the worst case scenario happened to ONC counties? Well, not only does the concept work, but it works fabulously well. In fact, he has pioneered its work in Astoria, from Portland, from Oregon Health Sciences to Astoria, and from Oregon Health Sciences to Pendleton. And what it is certainly no lack in care, or no lack in privacy, or no lack in professionalism from the physician to the patient. Everything is closed, private, as far as examinations and sessions. Everything is done at the very highest standard. In fact, Dr. Knight Richardson, being on faculty at Oregon Health Sciences, has told the people under his residency that this will be treated at the same or higher, the absolute highest degree of professionalism. So it's certainly not a lesser, it's a more technologically sophisticated way of reaching out to rural Oregon. And so that, and including our inability to help mental health in rural Oregon through the ONC panic, led to the bill. The other part that quite frankly led to the bill is Dr. Knight Richardson's work in New Orleans. This individual is really not only is he a cherished personal friend of mine and my wife and our family, but he's also a cherished resident of our state. This is a guy who's changed the mental health delivery system in Texas and Alaska, and certainly working with HHS around the globe. But in particular, he's been called in to use a model similar as this in post-Katrina New Orleans and Louisiana. So we know that the model does work. We know that there's a tremendous cost savings. And I know that there's been some controversy as it relates, maybe not controversy, but concern, plurally speaking, about how this bill would work as it relates to insurance coverage, how this bill would relate to the issues in Springfield at the hospital. I think we can get a really good product out of this. And so that's where I'm coming from, and I appreciate you making time for not only for me and for the bill, but also for Dr. Knight Richardson to call in. I think that would just if my testimony can be added, that's great. But his testimony is contagious, and that's a lot better.
Great question. All right, thank you. Well, we will be bringing this back on Wednesday, and if we can get Dr. Knight Richardson.
I'll get him.
On the phone. Okay, good. With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 519 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 153. Okay. Senator Morissette. Oh, you're here for a different bill? Is it 3-3?
No, he's
in a 5-4. Okay. We only have one to testify on 153. Okay. Tricia Baxter. Describe the bill.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 153 requires employee benefit plan and health insurers to reimburse state Medicaid expenditures made for benefit of enrollee under specified circumstances. It requires employee benefit plan and health insurer to provide eligibility and claims to state Medicaid agency upon request. Declares an emergency, takes effect upon passage.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Melissa Sanderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Baxter. I'm the administrator of the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery with the Department of Human Services, and I'm here today to testify in our support of Senate Bill 153. Passage of this bill will bring the state of Oregon into compliance with Section 6035 of the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005. The Deficit Reduction Act in Section 6035 does two things. First of all, it clarifies that entities that are liable for payment as third parties and health insurers, it clarifies who those entities are, and it clarifies that they cannot discriminate against individuals on the basis of Medicaid eligibility. Secondly, and more importantly, it requires that states pass laws that require health insurance companies to cooperate with the state Medicaid agency. It lays out time frames for which claims may be filed by the state Medicaid agency and time frames within which the third-party insurers must pay those claims or honor those claims. It also requires that they provide the state with eligibility and claims data coverage information. And so it's a simple bill. We have shared this information with the insurance companies through the Department of Consumer and Business Services website. The draft of the bill was up there for months before it became Senate Bill 153. Unfortunately, after the bill was drafted, we did receive some further guidance from the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, further clarifying what was meant by health insurers. So we do have an amendment in process, and I don't believe that you have that in front of you this morning. If you do, I haven't had a chance to see it. So this would need to come back to you after those amendments are drafted, and we had hoped they'd be in front of you prior to today. But with me is Cindy Becker. Cindy represents some of our managed care organizations, and I believe maybe Cindy has a few words to say about the bill also.
Thank you. And for the record, my name is Cindy Becker. I'm the Executive Director of the Coalition for Healthy Oregon. Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, I wanted to, on behalf of COHO, provide you with information that supports this bill, except for one thing that we have also asked to change, and that's in the amendments, I think, that Patricia was talking about, which would add prepaid managed care health services as well as the department's state Medicaid agency. Right now, the prepaid managed care organizations are responsible for collecting the third-party reimbursements for the individuals that they serve. The Department of Human Services collects it for the fee-for-service folks, and then we collect it for the managed care folks. And so we'd like to have the same authority or as the state Medicaid agency, because it's oftentimes not easy for us to get that information. So we feel that it makes sense, since we are responsible for collecting those funds for the managed care organizations, that we have the same authority.
Any questions? All right, we will also, will the amendments be done by Wednesday?
We certainly hope so, but unfortunately we don't have a lot of control over that.
Okay, well, what I would like is to reschedule Senate Bill 153 also for Wednesday. If the amendments are ready and if they seem pretty straightforward, then we can move them out. All right. Thank you for your time. Any other discussion on this bill? I'd like to close a public hearing on Senate Bill 153 and open a public hearing on 363, Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6, Lane and Linn County. This bill is about mental health consumers and psychiatric survivors who are probably the most underpowered and maligned people in the state of Oregon. And we're talking about building a new mental hospital to the tune of $400-500 million. Maybe it's billion. I don't know. I lose track. But we're not doing what we need to do at the present time to take care of the people who are suffering from mental health illnesses and disabilities. And so that's what this bill is about. It kind of carries over into Senate Bill 364, which is another bill, but they go together, and hopefully we might even combine them. So with that, I'm going to step aside. And Drake, did you want to?
Evidently, discussion is taking place about its potential. Excuse me, Madam Chair and the committee. Its potential for...
Please identify yourself.
Oh, my name is Drake Eubank, Robert Drake Eubank. I'm a operations coordinator for SAFE Incorporated, a nonprofit in Springfield, Oregon. The discussion has gone towards its feasibility of getting the bill that has money attached to it passed Ways and Means at this point. We're willing, I think at this point, anybody connected with the bill probably would be willing to introduce a way of amending 364 by adding the piece for the Consumer Council Advisory Committee, which is Section 3 in numbers Bill 363. It's a non-impact item, but it does include the consumer representation piece that's actually ongoing right now in the Mental Health Division. It would be a very simple amendment. It wouldn't require any extra authorship. That would be no fiscal impact and would basically have the principle in law that we're looking for, which is the support for self-determination and essentially a representative voice in the processes that decide how the services are configured. The other piece that I think people are willing to consider is the dropping of the ombudsman's requirement, Section 6 out of 363, because it seems to cause a lot of conflict with other bills. The one that is funded, we would like to see continue to have the Consumer Affairs Office piece, because the part of what this is about is that the services that are out there that people are continually saying are not ineffective. In my area, my standard service hour is about 7 cents. That essentially is a very significant support piece and keeps people out of the hospitals that you're about to build. The standard service hour for the mental health system under Medicaid is about $85, and I think the state average is $89. So just something to think about if you're looking for cost and comparativity there. Anyways, that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Bill Morissette said again, we're talking about perhaps combining Senate Bill 363 and 364 is what he...
So why don't I just open a public hearing for 364, too, and we can just all run it all together.
Okay, I apologize.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. I'm David Oakes, Director of Mind Freedom, and we're one of the groups in a new coalition, the Oregon Consumer Survivor Coalition, in which... mental health client groups are finally working together, forming a coalition, and we all strongly support this. I want to remind you that we actually had 25 mental health consumers and psychiatric survivors here, and I thank you so much for that opportunity to bring everybody together. And this is my 31st year doing this work, and I can tell you it's very, very special to have a whole lot of mental health consumers and psychiatric survivors from all over the state come here and speak out. And it was a very special occasion. I'm really proud of folks. The origin story for this, these two bills, it's important to know, came out of a statewide gathering of mental health consumers and psychiatric survivors from a federal grant called Real Choices for Systems Change. And at the end of this grant, the state brought together consumer survivor leaders from throughout the state and spent the day together with disability leaders, and we said, what are we going to do? We're so disempowered. And we realized that we couldn't just work on a money bill. everybody works on a money bill. In a way, right now, being a mental health advocate means you work for more money for mental health. And we realize there's something deeper here about disempowerment and about recovery and advocacy and human rights and citizenship and segregation. And so that's why we came up with this very, very simple, basic bill, as small a bill that we could conceive as possible, as a step toward having an Office of Consumer Affairs and an ombudsman. And the reason they were split was even to lower expectations even more, that because it didn't get into the governor's budget, even though Bob Nickel will tell you, you know, he's a big fan of this bill, to split it even more that, gee, if it doesn't get funding, maybe we can even get this little piece that doesn't even have any funding in it. So it really, that's the origin story for it, and anything you can do to combine them and get the whole thing passed would be tremendous. Last time we were here, we were reminded by Senator Carter that we're preaching to the choir. I know folks here very much support us, but I'll just end by saying that, you know, I got into this field because as a college student I ended up in the mental health system, and a lot of people think that being for mental health means that you're for money. You're for parity or more services or more money. And we're really for what I call democracy getting hands-on with the mental health system, to really get into the details. I'll mention one example. We're pro-choice on taking psychiatric drugs. A lot of our members take prescribed psychiatric drugs. But the problems that we're facing with the psychiatric drug industry are so immense in terms of fraud and marketing problems and their influence that they have. And those kind of issues, we don't have a chance to really get into the details. We're kind of like where nuclear power was in 1950, where people just said, oh, that's too complicated and we won't get into it. We're not a physicist. And so, in a way, that's where things are right now with mental health, is that it seems to be all about whether there should be more money or not. And what this bill is about is saying, let's get a voice for the clients. The clients, there's a diverse voice, but let's get a voice for the customers. If we want a customer-driven service, let's have support for that customer voice, especially when we're about to embark on $500 million endeavor for more institutions. Whether or not that's a good idea or not, we just have to have some kind of voice for the people who are on the receiving end, or as I say, on the sharp end of the needle. We have to have a voice for those folks, like the folks that were here the other day. And I won't repeat my comments. I've already submitted my written comments. But I would encourage you to see beyond the money issue and talk about the empowerment issue and the policy issues about client voice and client empowerment. Thanks. And thank you, Senator Morissette, by the way, for being a champion of this very disenfranchised group.
Now, I know that Mr. Eubanks said it, but would you also be okay with taking out the Office of Ombudsman for Mental Health Consumers, since that seems to be the stickler at this point in time?
I'm not an expert in this. When I heard I tried to listen carefully, and I understood that the question was that there's so many different groups asking for an ombudsman, and we're gonna be happy with whatever we get. But I'll tell you this: if any group needs an ombudsman, my goodness, let the other ones wait in line. We still haven't, like I said, we still haven't quite figured out what to do with the ashes from our folks from the current institution. If any group needs an ombudsman, so I'll disagree a little bit with Drake in that we'd love to have everything in those bills. But as you know, we're just saying, give us something, you know.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Yeah.
Brief comment. The piece that is the Consumer Affairs Office, if you look at the letter detail of that, actually covers the analysis of the effectiveness of services. I think in a lot of ways you get a de facto ombudsman's function out of that, because he'll be looking at what actually works in the system. And I think many people would consider that to be a more proactive way of dealing with a lot of the issues that the ombudsman would end up dealing with the back end of. So,
okay.
Thank you.
All right. Questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just a note again for the record that we heard testimony the last time this bill was up that mm-hmm. of the 50 states, Oregon is one of three without an office that does this kind of work. time to get busy. Thank you.
Madam Chair, may I mention something about that? I think a good example would be Vermont, which is kind of a similarly sized state. They have a $500,000 mental health consumer affairs division with a wonderful newspaper, annual conferences. The consumers there have a voice. They're really speaking out, and it's exciting to see. And we can lead here in Oregon.
Yes, we can.
Yeah.
All right. Karen, thank you. Karen Cormack-Jones and Megan Cahey.
Cahey.
Sorry. Excuse me. Madam Chair, good morning, and members of the committee. My name is Karen Cormack-Jones. I'm from Salem, and I'm here again to testify in support of Senate Bill 363. Last time I was here on March 14th, I included some data showing that the Oregon Board of Psychologist Examiners imposed disciplinary action on only 13 of 293 consumer complaints received by the board between 2000 through 2004. That's a five-year period. Today, I am providing you with a copy of an article from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer from October of 2005, which states on page 2, and I've highlighted it there, in Oregon and Louisiana, consumers do not have a right to information about complaints that close without sanctions. Actually, we don't have a right to information about complaints that close with sanctions either, but as the article states, in Washington State, they do have that right. Also in Washington State, consumers can call the state to ask how many complaints a doctor has on his record, how they were resolved. They can even ask for copies of those complaints, including those that close without sanctions. In Oregon, you can't even find out which practitioners have been sanctioned, much less any information on the types of complaints that were received. I'm choosing not to read the next paragraph aloud because I want to protect my son's privacy.
But we did receive your statement
yes.
before, so you do not
you.
Need to really repeat what you've already stated. But if there's any other information.
I would like to say that if I could have my complaint out there, I could help other parents make a decision as to whether they want their child to be alone in a room with a psychologist at this particular facility. They would be a lot more informed. Right now, it's a big black hole out there, and I just think that it's odd that the state of Washington has all these protections for consumers that we do not have. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to testify in support of SB 363. My name is Megan Cahey. My experience is that I've been hospitalized over 100 times and received various shock treatments and have been in recovery for the past 8 years and am now having the pleasure to serve as a peer advocate and give something back to my community. And my experience is that the values of self-determination and empowerment have been shown in the proof of my life to be what contributes to recovery even in the darkest of circumstances in a person's life. You spoke earlier about wanting a comprehensive mental health bill and needing that. Well, SB 363 has the elements of a comprehensive bill in that it will affect Oregonians with mental health issues all across the state. And we have the frustration of a mental health system that, on one hand, you talk about the many years of experience that you have gone into the task force, the mental health task force that you've served on. And the first impulse is that you want to fix the mental health system. But I'm saying to fix the mental health system is maybe not the best idea, because to fix something like a mental health system actually perpetuates some of the problems that are ingrained in it. Maybe a better vision is to transform it. And transforming the mental health system means, to me, embracing the ideas of recovery and empowerment and self-determination. SB 363 has elements of recovery and self-determination. And that is what proved in my life to be crucial for my recovery. When I became empowered and discovered a strong sense of self-determination, I quit going to the hospital. When people become empowered and have a sense of self-determination, they'll quit filling those finite hospital beds. That's why SB 363 is so important.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Questions? All right. Bob Nickel. Last one. And as Senator Morissette's out there listening, I just wanted to... it sounds like there's possibility of amendments, so I assume that that's what we will wait for. Okay.
Madam Chair, again for the record, Bob Nickel, DHS, and responsible for the Addictions and Mental Health Division. I just want to say briefly, we'd be happy to work with an amendment process for these two bills. I do want to put on the record that there still is some cost associated with the Office of Consumer Affairs, and so I don't want us to run blindly into this thinking that that would entirely do away with costs. I would need to go back and take a look at our analysis and see to what degree there were three FTE that were associated with Senate Bill 363, and I need to figure out exactly where the split would be. Despite the fact that there is some cost here, the division and the department have taken a neutral stance on this because our recognition of the absolute importance of having this kind of a position again at some point in this state. We did have one a number of years ago. The cuts of 2002 and 2003 reluctantly led us to have to cut every state general fund dollar to non-Medicaid services for adults and crisis services. We cut acute care hospital costs for indigent adults, and we cut the entire Office of Consumer Affairs at that point. We would love to have it back, and I just want to go on record as being in full support of the concept of the bill.
Great. So with that, committee, are there any questions? If you would work with Senator Morissette, who then works with the advocates, come up with some amendments so that we can move this bill, because we need to know a fiscal on whether we send it to Ways and Means or not. Yes, and Mr. Eubanks wants to come to the and have one more statement.
I just wanted to clarify. My name is Drake Eubanks, Madam Chairman. The 363 does have a fiscal impact, and that won't change. But 364 can be adapted so that all the non-fiscal parts of 363 can be functional, so it could be moved on. So,
okay. Well, we'll have. Thank you. We will have Senator Morissette working with you and with Mr. Nickel on coming up with some amendments so that we can move it, because we only have a few weeks left to get these bills out of the Senate and over to the House. Thank you very much. With that, yes. I'd like to close the work session or the public hearing on 363 and 364.
Madam Chair, before you do that, thank you. I just wanted to say to Megan Cahay, I really appreciated your words today and at the previous hearing as well. And you are also a wonderful writer. I'm looking at your written testimony and the statement that you have here, which says, my life has increased in beauty and overall quality, and it is now better than I once thought it could ever be. I am filled with gratitude for my life, and it is now my work to support the lives of persons with mental health issues in Oregon and everywhere. It's a beautiful statement and expression, and we're blessed. We're absolutely blessed to have you doing this work. Thank you.
I appreciate
thank you.
That. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other comments? All right, we are carrying over 791, 519, and 153 to Wednesday regarding 363 and 364. We will wait for those amendments and then move the bill then. Also, our meeting will be 8 o'clock, not 7:15, because we had a posting problem. So it'll be 8 o'clock on Monday. With that, we're adjourned. 8 o'clock.